Okay, so we're doing romancey, weird romance. Ba ra ba ba ra ra ma ma
ga ga la. What's your romance? Exactly.
That'll get cut. I'm like, can we sing that if it's, like, you know, copyrighted? Probably not.
You're allowed to sing. I think you're allowed to use.
I think there's, like, a 5 second under, like, yeah. Okay, so I guess we should do an intro.
Mm-hmm.
Hold on, I gotta drink first. All right, so are you ready to do an intro?
Go for it.
Hello, and welcome to Flights of Fancy, a drunken adventure through mythology.
Amen.
That's certainly a descriptor for it. I'm Kate.
I'm Trish.
And we're gonna do something, that's for sure.
We're gonna tell some stories.
We certainly are going to do something by the end of this, that's for goddamn sure. I'm not sure what we're gonna do, but we're certainly gonna do something. It's the last episode of the night, and then we get into our drunken drinking songs. Welcome to Flights of Fancy. Today, we're gonna be talking about weird romances.
Oh, yeah.
Which are not uncommon throughout the entirety of mythology. But all told, we're gonna be touching on some interesting, but not totally out the window, uncle coming in you and you catching your hands level weirdness.
So, Kate, what are you talking about today?
Listen, we have to do the funny, stupid thing where I have to say, in the ancient traditions, as passed down from ancestor to the modern day, by who the fuck can I reference today?
Apollo.
Apollo. As passed down to me by Apollo in, if we stick to Rick Riordan, shitty haiku format.
I would hope it's shitty haiku format.
As passed down from the ancients by the tradition of Apollo.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be the one going first today. As Apollo has decreed thousands and thousands of years ago, before I was ever even considered being born, Kate goes first. So today, in the weird romance front, I will be telling you about Eros and Psyche, also known as Get Consent Before You Get Up to Wax Play, kiddos.
Yep.
And you should use paraffin wax candles, not the random fucking candles you pick up at any store.
The reason why you do that is because paraffin wax melts at a lower temperature point than regular wax, and therefore is safer to use on skin.
Exactly. So you don't get giant, horrifying burns using the paraffin wax.
This is sex FAQ from,
Flights of Fancy's sex FAQ. I'm sure this would be a really weird Patreon episode at some point. We could do that.
Oh, we definitely could.
We definitely could. Practice safe kinky sex, y'all.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways.
Continue.
This could definitely be an interesting Patreon episode. Mythologically, why you should practice safe kink. Okay. So today we're going to be talking about Eros and Psyche, or why wax play requires consent, y'all.
Yep.
And paraffin candles. But mostly consent. So, as a quick scooch backstory, you may remember from the third or so episode, where I talked about Aphrodite's famous child. You're cat the sticking cat. The fucking paws.
Was she sticking them under?
Yeah, I just saw a Peggy paw under the fucking door.
To be fair, we are in her room.
We're in her room, but also it was adorable and hilarious.
Come on.
If you hear some jingles, it's because there's a fucking cat collar in the room.
Her name is Peggy Carter.
Her name is Peggy. You're such fucking nerds. And she's like a mutt kitty with a hard level of Egyptian metal mix in there. Because she's spotty and she's got the weird M shape on her forehead.
And she's got the scarab beetle on her forehead.
Scarab beetle, rather, on her forehead. So she's like an Egyptian mount rando mix.
Mm-hmm. She's from St. Thomas. She came with me from the Caribbean.
St. Thomas. She's a little bit of a shit. She is also like kitten size forever. Teenager cat size forever. She probably wants out now.
I agree.
Realistically, Peggy is Patricia's husband's cat. Much like Maisie the corgi is Patricia's dog.
However, I agreed
Peggy
to that cat.
Peggy is Jeff's first cat.
Peggy came first, and I agreed to it, even though I wanted a black and white cat and I ended up with that thing, but it's fine. She's actually a really great cat.
Anyways, as we were saying earlier in the episode, today we're going to be talking about really strange romances.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I'm going to be talking about Eros and Psyche. As a bit of preface, you may remember Eros, or Cupid, as he's more commonly known, from my earlier episode about Aphrodite. He's the most well-known child of Aphrodite. And most people are more familiar with him by the name of Cupid. Here's the thing, though. He is not a weird chubby baby with wings. He's hot. He's a babe. He's like if you took the hottest man alive and made him like 1,000 times hotter. So like Chris Evans with an 8-pack and also literally glowing.
I'm sorry, is it weird that you went to Chris Evans and I went to Sebastian Stan?
Here's the thing. Chris Evans is showy muscly. Sebastian Stan is built like a refrigerator, and I also want to hit that.
I also would like to hit that. I'm married
and but I'm talking about Chris Evans like show muscle. Because he's built for show muscle. Again, Sebastian Stan is built for actual strength.
Excuse me. I'd like to point out that this is the thing that we talked about in the Aphrodite episode where, like...
I want to bang all of them.
No, not that. It's that Aphrodite, like...
Have you the seen the bronze, though?
The thing that we talked about, Rick Riordan and his, like, depiction of Aphrodite, the concept that she's the most Aphrodite attractive to whoever is looking at them.
There's no wrong answers. I feel like
Eros would be the same thing. So to Eros, you, Chris Evans is the most attractive. To me, Sebastian Stan
But,
is.
Like, times 1,000 and glowing. Mm. Excellent. Anyways, so today, Eros and Psyche. And let's delve into the fucking history. This is so, as backstory for Eros and Psyche, while you may not recognize the name Eros per se, although you may recognize him from like the from the word erotic.
Ew.
Because sexy sex.
Hmm.
However, you are probably more familiar with Eros's Roman counterpart, Cupid.
That's the chubby baby with the wings.
That is the version that everyone knows. But here's the fact of the matter. Eros slash Cupid from Greco-Roman mythology is hot. I hear he's ripped. I hear he's got an 8-pack. Because he's literally like the god of like sexy lust good times. He's the god of like sexual desire and lust and shit.
Again, like Eros is the word. Sensual, the name Eros gives birth to the word erotic.
Erotic. If something is erotic, it is literally of or pertaining to Eros, who is a hot bitch.
Yup.
Which you may remember him from my story about the birth of Aphrodite, because he is the most well-known of Aphrodite's children.
Yes.
Because he's a hot bitch.
She's a hot bitch, he's a hot bitch,
she's everybody a hot bitch, bitches. He's a hot bitch, it's great. So, I'm going to be using Eros because I don't like the name Cupid, because I tend to default to Grecian mythology, not Roman mythology, personally.
Agreed.
And Cupid is his Roman name. I prefer the Greek versions of the mythologies. I grew up reading the Greek versions. Okay, so Eros is the son of Aphrodite and Ares, and the god of sensual love and desire. He has, like, bunches and bunches of brothers and sisters, like, at least 7. I don't know.
Many.
There's a lot. But that's not really relevant to the story I'm telling. So, yeah, he's a god of love, sensual love specifically, and desire. He shoots arrows at people. So if you ever heard of, like, the arrows of Cupid, that concept. He shoots the arrows of love at people, but he also, and those are fletched with I don't remember what.
I don't
remember. And then
either.
He also shoots the arrows of indifference, which are fletched with owl feathers.
Yeah, that shit's worse.
Because in Greek mythology, and also realistically in regular life, the difference between their hate is not the opposite of love, because they're both a very passionate concept. The opposite of love is indifference. Love and indifference are opposites, because there's a passionate thing and there's a dispassionate thing. Love is passionate, indifference is dispassionate. You don't care, versus love or hate, you care deeply. I don't remember what fletches the arrows of love, but I know for a fact from many years of mythology nerdiness that the fletching of the arrows of indifference is owl feathers. I don't know why, but that's stuck with me my entire life.
Because nerds don't know what love is.
Those are the important bits. Child of the goddess of love. He's the god of sensual love and desire. He's got them arrows. Those are the important bits for this story.
Mm-hmm.
This is a long story, so, like, get comfy, nerds.
Sit down, cuddle up, get some alcohol.
Because also, all of this is gonna be long.
Or if you don't drink, whatever drink brings you comfort.
Get a milkshake, get a Coke, I don't know.
So, real honest sidebar, if you hear me disappear from the conversation, it's because I have these snacking peas.
And that'll happen with me later during Trisha's story.
And they're very crunchy, so I can't sit in front of the mic and eat them.
But they're so weirdly delicious.
They're so good. So, like, if this you hear that I've disappeared, it's not that I'm not listening to Kate tell her story. It's that I've stepped out of the range of the microphone.
Don't worry.
So that I can go...
Yeah. Gang, 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 gang. On these weird, crunchy pee things that are amazing and horrible.
Exactly. I buy them from Lucky's, if you're wondering.
Oh, yeah. If you live in, like, what, the South?
Not even. Lucky's Markets are across the U.S.
Are they?
But it's Lucky's Market. It's one of those weird, like, you know, bougie, like... food stores, but
it's
they're
like Sprouts, but a little different.
It's like if you cross a Trader Joe's and a Sprouts, you'd end up with the Luckies. These freaking crunchy peas are like crack, so like don't worry if you don't hear me.
So there was a king and he had three daughters, the youngest of which is our main girl Psyche, who was an absolute babe. Like, she was literally so gorgeous. She made everyone else look like hot flaming garbage, even her beautiful fucking sisters. But that was a problem because she was so gorgeous that all of her admirers started praying and making offerings to her instead of Aphrodite, which is a problem in general. She was so gorgeous that they were like, oh, she must be the second coming of Aphrodite, right? She must be the second coming of Aphrodite. Or that Psyche must be the daughter of Aphrodite and, like, some mortal like her dad or whatever.
That's a problem.
Bad. No good. Aphrodite was not about that shit. She was not fucking happy. Aphrodite was not happy, obviously. Because, like, who the fuck is this random-ass mortal Psyche-ass bitch or whatever the fuck getting all this worship and praise and shit instead of the actual, literal goddess of beauty and love and banging and all of that jazz? And so Aphrodite, angry as fuck, calls up her baby boy Eros, her best son, her best boy, and goes, hey, kiddo, can you, like, do me a favor and just, like, shoot Psyche with an arrow of love and make her fall in love with something, like, stupid and ugly as fuck? And Eros is like, yeah, I guess, mom. Okay, I guess. Because he's a mama's boy.
Yes, he is. A huge one.
Eros is a huge mama's boy, and that comes in later. But also just know in general, Eros is a mama's boy. And so, the problem is, though, he goes to, like, he finds her, he sees her, he knocks his arrow, except he accidentally, like, nicks himself with the arrow while he's looking at her when he's about to shoot it, and so instead he falls in love with Psyche because his arrows work real fast and real strong.
Immediately
and deeply and irreversibly, almost. So, like, when he's trying to shoot her with an arrow to make her fall in love with something fucking stupid, he accidentally cuts himself on the tip of it and falls deeply and irrevocably in love with her, with Psyche. Which is, like, you know, surprisingly, a good thing for Eros, because Psyche still is unwed.
Yes.
She is still...
Lucky for him, this is one of those weird Greek myths where nobody's married and nobody is in, like, mortal danger. So,
weirdly,
like,
enough, yeah. It actually goes better than expected. Everything went better than expected at JPG over here.
Or, like,
so she's not married or anything.
Like, what's his face from Moulin Rouge? Everything's going so well.
So, unlike her two older sisters, she doesn't have a husband or she's not even betrothed. But here's the bad news.
Whoa.
Her dad thinks it's because Psyche being single. Her dad thinks Psyche's single because they've somehow drawn the ire and the wrath of the gods. And so dad goes over onto the Oracle of Apollo, not necessarily of Delphi, just the Oracle of Apollo. It doesn't say specifically. Mm. Regardless, a high-ass teenage girl or whatever the fuck, to be like, okay, give me some advice, because, like, my daughter still isn't betrothed. I bonked that. My daughter still isn't betrothed or whatever.
Yes.
And this seems concerning because we're Greek and our daughters need to be married off by the age of, like, 14. I'm exaggerating, but I'm also really not exaggerating. And so, here's the problem, though. Worse news. The Oracle does their prophecy shit and says, okay, like, yeah, well, don't expect a normal son-in-law. Your daughter Psyche is gonna marry, like, a creepy dragon monster thing, and, like, even the gods are terrified of it. It's that fucked up. So, I mean, that's not great. It's not good.
Full of shit those gods were. They lied when it suited them.
Yeah, and they lied to the fucking oracles. This is a whole thing. But yeah, so they're like, yo, your daughter's gonna marry a creepy dragon shit. Or whatever the fuck.
Sure.
And so, her dad, I don't even remember what he's king of. But so Psyche's dad breaks the news to Psyche, and it's not great. So Psyche gets all dressed up in, like, funerary attire and shit.
Lol.
And because, you know, you gotta be extra. And so they take her to this cliff where the oracle said she would be picked up by her husband. And so she gets all dressed up in her funeral best because it's Greek mythology and we're extra ass bitches. And so they take her to, like, the edge of this cliff that the oracle told them to go to.
Yeah.
And have, like, this weird funeral/wedding service. And then, whoosh, Zephyros.
Yes.
The West Wind. The West Wind.
Yep.
Because there are personifications of all the North, South, West, East
yep.
wind. Because Greek mythology. So Zephyros, the West Wind, sweeps Psyche up in her weird funeral garb and carries her off into God's nowhere.
Nobody knows where.
Carries her off to, actually though, it's a super lovely little meadow.
Yeah, and it's beautiful.
It's nice. Gorgeous. And from there, she falls asleep, which, I mean, it's been a really weird long day. I don't blame her. So eventually she wakes up. And she's suddenly outside of this, like, fancy little manor home mansion thing. Like, it's absolutely gorgeous and pretty and it's lush and there's all these nifty things. Out of nowhere, as she's waking up, stands up, looks at this weird fucking house out of nowhere, there's just an invisible voice going, "Welcome home! Get comfy, bitch. Get comfy, girl. Make yourself literally at home, because it's your home now." And then, like, she goes in, there's, like, this feast served by invisible people, and then, like, she's singing as an invisible person plays the lyre, and it's just pretty fucking nice. It's pretty okay. And then, after her dinner and singing with lyre and invisible peeps and everything is over, she gets led into a bedroom. Insert eyebrow waggle here. And it is pitch black, because it's after the sun is set, and there's no lanterns or windows or anything. And apparently, she's told that her new husband is there and waiting for her. And they bang. Gotta consummate the marriage and shit. So they bang. As I said in the Logie story, they bone town.
Yep.
They
lay in that pipe.
Go to bone town. Bangarang indeed. Because, you know, gotta consummate that marriage, bitch.
Yeah, hell yeah.
And then, okay, so over days and weeks, or whatever the over a while.
The time period is unclear.
Time period's unclear, because, you know, it's mythology. Time is kind of wibbly-wobbly to begin with. So, over an eventual amount of time, she actually kind of grows to like these nights with her mystery invisible husband in the dark. Like, she grows emotionally attached to him, and also, she likes the fucking, I guess.
Well, in some of the myths, it shows that they talk.
They talk. No, that's what I'm saying. Like, not only does she enjoy the banging part, but, like, they talk, they get to know each other. So, you know, she genuinely grows to kind of, like, enjoy his presence and love him. But the problem is, he only ever shows up after dark, and he always leaves before the first light of dawn. So she's literally never seen him. And she's always been told, you know, he's this weird dragon monster thing.
So, okay. Here is my problem with
okay.
the myth of Eros and Psyche, right?
Oh.
And this has been a thing that has bugged me for my entire fucking life.
All right, tell me.
Even as a child, I understood that having sex with somebody involves being close to somebody, right? You know?
It's an emotional closeness.
No.
Emotional intimacy, right?
Physical closeness.
Oh,
physically close,
physical.
Too, right?
Yeah, also
so,
that. How do you not, like, feel...
How do you not... touch the person that you're fucking when you're fucking them?
I guess if you're not running your hands all over them, maybe you don't recognize that they're this creepy dragon thing.
But
listen!
Even so, you're gonna touch their shoulders, you're gonna touch their waist, you're probably gonna grab their ass because it's just what happens when
you
have sex.
I guess it depends on if you're having, what's the Christian version, faithful, non-touching missionary position.
We're gonna assume because they're Greek.
Because
they're touching.
They're touching.
So, like, you can feel the outline of their body. I can tell you for a fact. If I were blindfolded, I could tell who my husband was because I know what he feels like with no lights on.
But it's weird Greek shit, and she obviously has never had sex before.
Whatever.
Whatever.
It doesn't even matter. It doesn't matter. I could tell you what you look like without looking at you. Like, if somebody blindfolded me and put three people that look next to each other, like, look like you next to each other.
You're like, feel, you know me.
I'd know who you are.
That's real gay.
I mean, kind of, but I feel like that's
what we've also known each other for 18 years. Fun fact for the listeners, we've known each other for literally 18 years in June 2019.
Mm-hmm.
It's really uncomfortable at this point. At this point, the only reason we can stop being friends is if one of us murdered the other.
Pretty much. Continue. So she gets pregnant.
So she gets preggo. She gets fucking pregnant. She gets knocked the fuck up.
Yep.
And so eventually, because she begs the vague invisible servants, she begs everybody, she finally gets mystery boyfriend to summon up Zephyros to carry her sisters over for a visit because she really misses her family and they miss her. And I mean, they think she's been married off to like the fucking swamp thing or some shit. Weird, creepy monster thing.
Yes.
And so finally, the sisters get dragged over by Zephyros because they go hang out at the cliff and get brought over. Here's the thing, though. Her sisters, who aren't unattractive, but they aren't as hot
super massive as bitches. Psyche.
And also, they're cunts.
They get like the evil stepsisters from Cinderella.
Yeah. But yeah, her sisters who aren't not unattractive, but they aren't as hot as Psyche, are like, they get brought over to this like mystery fantastic manor, and they're like, what the fuck? I want this.
Mm-hmm.
And they get like super jealous because like she's literally living in splendor. How is this fair? This is preposterous.
Mind you, they're married off like princesses.
They've been married for like years now. And they probably have kids. It's a whole other thing. But they're still like, what the fuck? This is so fantastic. This isn't even fair. And so, they do that thing sisters do, I assume. I don't have sisters. But they do the thing that siblings do, because I do have brothers. Where they're like, they'll find that one thing that really will fuck up Psyche. And they dig their fingers into it.
Mm-hmm.
Just poke it and poke it and poke it until it's a problem. And in this case, that's a, wow! So, like, you've never seen your husband because he's definitely a freaky dragon swamp thing. And he's, and, like, you're pregnant, right? So he's gonna, like, eat you and your kid once you have your child. So, like, freaky dragon thing. And I mean, because siblings are the worst, they get under Psyche's skin, as siblings do, and it fucking freaks her out. So her sisters get taken back over by Zephyros or whatever the fuck. Get taken back over to their husbands and shit, and Psyche's like low-key freaking out because of her sister her sister's bullshit.
Yep.
As Psyche do. So because her siblings have been utter shite, she kind of low-key freaks out after her sisters leave. So Psyche gets her an knife and candle. Or a lamp, depends on the mythology, but I like candle better. It's more aesthetic. So she gets a knife and a candle. And so she sneaks into their bedroom while her husband's asleep.
Like a bitch.
So she can like kill him or whatever.
No, of course not.
But so she sneaks in with the candle lit. And she's like, got the knife in the other hand, the candle in the one hand. She goes in and she lights it up. And she's like, oh no. He's like the fucking squid. Oh no, he's hot.
Jesus, help.
He's so fine. He is, though. He is fine.
So hot.
So fucking hot. God damn. And so she's like so fucking surprised that she backs into the quiver, which he discarded when he passed the fuck out. Cuts herself open on one of those love arrows. And because she cuts herself open on a love arrow, she's like overcome with wanting to bang, wants to bone down again. And here's the problem though. She's hella into it. But she moves so fast that with her candle She drips some hot wax on him, onto his chest, because, you know, he passed out fucking naked, because live your best life, Eros. So she drips some hot wax onto his chest, and it burns him, and he wakes up, because, you know, hot wax hurts like a motherfucker. And so Eros flips the fuck out, which is reasonable, all told. He flips out from the hot wax dripping on his fucking chest while he was sleeping, and he like, jumps out a window and flies off, yelling, "Love cannot live without trust." That's a whole thing of the story. Love cannot live So Eros, woken up with hot-ass fucking wax, lays out a window and flies off, yelling, "Love cannot live without trust," as he ollies out into the fucking night. And so Psyche tries to chase him down because, like, what the fuck? But the problem is, he's a god with wings and shit, and he can fly and stuff. And she's literally immortal with just feet, so she's kind of shit out of luck. So, it doesn't work out. She does not catch him, obviously. So instead, she just, like, she's bummed. She's bummed as fuck. And so she just, like, decides to wander off across fucking Earth. In some legends, as she's wandering off across the fucking lands, she runs into Pan, recognizes him as a god, because it's like a whole thing with Pan, that's a whole other story, where Pan is not always recognized as like a big deal god, but she recognizes Pan, and then she continues wandering off. And so, it doesn't go well. So she wanders the fuck off. And then, so she goes off to visit both of her sisters, because she's got two sisters, remember, and they're both assholes. She goes out to visit them and tells them what happened. She's like, "I saw my husband and he was fucking fine. And then he flew off because I fucked up." And then she keeps going. And both of her sisters are, again, hella jealous, because she had the fancy house, she had the super fine husband. And so, one at a time, after she visits one, and then after she visits the other, one at a time, they go up to the cliffs that she was originally taken from, and, like, shout out to Zephyros that, like, "Hey, I'm great, take me up to this fancy bougie fucking house," and they jump off the cliff, and Zephyros and Eros are both like, "Nah." So one falls to her death, and then later the other one goes up like, "Hey, I'm hot, I want to marry a handsome boy and live in a fancy house," jumps off a cliff and falls to her fucking death. I mean, they kind of deserved it, all told, because they're like, they Myron. Caught him Myron, man. And yeah, so both of her sisters fall to their fucking death. Womp womp.
It's because they suck.
It's because they totally sucked. They were bitches. Psyche, in her wandering about the fucking Earth, wanders off to some fucking temples.
Sounds like Rome.
I mean, that sounds like Greece or Rome.
Yeah.
Sounds like all of that shit in that time period from, like, you know, for, like, a couple thousand years or whatever. So first, Psyche swings through Demeter's temple, and it's a fucking mess. So she takes her time and tidies it up, and after she does that, Demeter is so fucking pleased with this that she straight up appears in, like, an apparition vision thing to Psyche. And Psyche's like, "Okay, do you think you could possibly help me find my fucking husband?" And Demeter's like, "Listen, Saws babe, can't go against other goddesses."
Yep.
And Psyche's like, "Okay, that's fair. I'm not gonna fault you for that." And carries on. And I mean, the same approximate process repeats at Hera's temple. And even Hera's like, "I'm sorry. Listen, you did good. I want to help you, but I can't."
Yep.
"Because another goddess is in charge of this shit right now. And I can't fuck again. I can't go against another goddess." "I can't." You know,
she said Aphrodite?
No, Hera said, "I can't fuck it."
Oh, yeah, yeah. That makes sense.
Hera can't fuck with a goddess. Struggle.
Can't fuck her own husband, so, like,
you know, it's a struggle, but she stands her ground. And again, Psyche's like, I'm not gonna fucking make you do things that you're not comfortable with, because Psyche is honestly too good for all of us.
True.
She's too good, too pure. Cinnamon roll, too good, too pure. Eventually, Psyche figures out that the problem is Aphrodite. And so Psyche is like, "All right, I gotta go to Aphrodite outright to be like, okay, come on, please help a bitch out." Aphrodite loves that shit with, like, Psyche going to her to ask for help. Because Aphrodite is kind of like, fuck you in particular, because everyone thought you were the second coming of Aphrodite. So fuck you. It's not your fault, but also fuck you. Is basically where that lands in a lot of women v. women in Greek mythology. It's not your fault, but fuck you anyway. Okay, so Aphrodite really enjoys Psyche coming to her for help. Because, like, fuck you in particular. And so Psyche's basically, like, prostrate at Aphrodite's feet. And Aphrodite decides it is time for some motherfucking torture. And assign some fucking tasks one at a time. And so we launch into task numero uno. Aphrodite takes, like, a bunch of baskets of, like, grains, like barley and wheat and chickpeas and all this other shit. Beans, whatever the fuck. And dumps them into a big mixed-up pile in front of Psyche. And she's like, okay, nerd, sort all this shit by sunrise or you fail and you never get to see Eros again. And then she leaves Psyche to that and wanders off to go to, like, a party or a wedding or some shit and leaves her to cry because, like, Psyche's just like, what the fuck? This is a literally impossible task. And she and Psyche freaks out and cries because, I mean, that seems like a reasonable reaction to something like this, realistically. I mean, like, in addition to trying to be like, okay, I'm gonna figure this out, like, crying is a perfectly reasonable reaction at this point. And so, an ant, like an ant.
An ant.
But we're talking about an aunt. It'd be an aunt. It's an ant. An aunt versus an ant. So an auntie hears Psyche crying because, I mean, that's a valid thing to cry about because it's fucked up. So an aunt hears Psyche crying and decides, okay, I'm going to help this bitch out. And so it helps her sort all the different grains into different piles. And so by the time Aphrodite gets back in the morning from this wedding or party, whatever the fuck, literally this impossible task has been done because the aunt has helped Psyche. And technically Aphrodite never said at any point that she couldn't get help. And so, but however, this impossible task is done and Aphrodite, she mad. Because, like, it's been fucking done. That's bullshit, according to Aphrodite.
Yeah.
But, I mean, like, fine though, because it didn't violate any weird terms of this thing that she didn't lay out. So, whatever. Here, have an crust of bread. Like, a single crust of bread. You don't get, like, real food. You get a crust of bread. Meanwhile, though, in the background, parenthetical statement, Eros is at his mom's house, crying and recovering from, like, his burn and his upset.
Like a bitch.
A little bit. Listen, he's not emotionally mature. Let him have his day. But, like, you know, this is, like, his first relationship.
I guess, yeah, or whatever. Sure.
But, like, he's over at mom's house crying into the couch and shit. Recovering from his birth. Mom, I loved her so much, but then she didn't trust me. Yeah, terrible. You know. Listen, you can only expect so much from the gods, okay? Cut Eros some slack. He's a good boy, but it's rough. Considering Aphrodite is his mom, it's rough. Okay, so since it turns out that Psyche has managed to pass this first weird, bizarre, impossible task of sorting out the grains, Aphrodite is like, fine! Task number two. Go across this fucking river and fetch me the golden fleece from these literal bloodthirsty man-eating sheep of god. Not Apollo, necessarily, as far as the sun god goes, because this is kind of weirdly before-ish, because Greek mythology doesn't really adhere to time proper. So go steal some of the golden fleece from Helios's bloodthirsty man-eating sheep. You know, like Jason and the Argonauts level shit from this mortal woman. And it's across this raging river that's realistically, basically impossible to cross. And Psyche's like, guess I'll kill myself! And plans to throw herself into the fucking river and drown. She plans to fucking literally drown. She's like, well, I can't do this. Guess I'll just fucking die. But then, no fucking joke, this magical reed, like the kind of reed that you use to make like a flute and shit, a reed, tells Psyche how to gather some of this like wool, cotton, some briars and shit near the sheep, but far enough away that they won't try to fucking eat her. So she gathers up some of this golden fleece. And, like, task done with no fucking risk to life or limb here. Because it's far enough away from the sheep that I don't try to fucking eat her.
Mm-hmm.
And so she takes that back to Aphrodite. And Aphrodite's like, ugh.
God damn it, why would you die?
Just die already, God. Like, me. Honestly, why won't you fucking die? And so Aphrodite's like, fine, when will this bitch go away / die? But, you know, she's already fucking dedicated herself to this weird path. So she keeps going, because she gotta. Aphrodite gotta. She's like, fucking die, but all right. And so next we move on to task number three. Psyche, for task number three, has to go get some, like, fancy spring water, and this springs feed the underworld rivers, like, so they feed the cool cottage insects. Fancy underworld spring waters for the underworld rivers.
Yeah.
Gotta go get this water and put it in this weird crystal container, but also it's up a mountain, and the mountain is covered in dragons.
Hmm.
Covered in fucking dragons. And, like, straight up, that's fucking impossible, no matter how you cut it. Straight up, goddamn impossible. And here's what I literally have in notes. And along came Zeus!
Here's the thunderbolt!
Anyway, but literally, though, along comes fucking Zeus, except instead of a penis, he sends an eagle! Which is better.
That is better.
That is objectively, ostensibly better. Along came Zeus, he hurled his eagle to go get these fucking, fight these dragons and get this fucking water in this weird crystal bottle. So Psyche doesn't have to do it. Because, you know, once in a while, Zeus isn't a raging douche.
He's just a normal level douche.
He's a frat bro, not literally the worst, you know?
He's just kind of a dick.
He's kind of a dick, but he's not a total douche. And so the eagle, like, fights all these fucking dragons and shit and fills up this crystal bottle of water from this weird wellspring of these underworld rivers and brings it back to Psyche so she can take it to Aphrodite and pass the trial. And Aphrodite has had it up to fucking here! With this passing her bullshit test nonsense. She's like, these are supposed to be impossible. What the fuck?
Yeah.
Stop it. I don't want you. Go away. Aphrodite is so fucking done. Had it up to here with this shit. Of this passing her impossible test nonsense. So, she makes this next one, like, actually factually impossible, right? We're on to task number four, which is go down to the underworld and get Persephone to give a drop of her beauty into this here box.
Yike.
Because apparently, because Aphrodite's been taking care of her very upset and wounded child, Eros, she needs a little bit of a beauty boost from Persephone,
of course,
who is
obviously
gorgeous. Not quite as gorgeous, but gorgeous enough to, like, make up the difference, right? Psyche's like, fuck. Definitely can't do this. I'm just gonna throw myself off a fucking tower. Buh-boy.
Bye.
And then, except the literal fucking tower. Like, the actual literal tower she's about to throw herself off of starts talking to her?
How many drugs is she on?
No, I literally think I said, I'm like, what are the Greeks smoking? And can I have some? Like, what the fuck? She's about to throw herself off of a literal tower. Like, in a castle or shit.
What kind of drugs is she on?
She's about to throw herself off of a big-ass stone structure. And then said structure starts talking to her. Please pass me some of those. Because it sounds like a good time. What the fuck? like, what are the Greeks smoking, and can I get some?
Island of the Lotus Eaters all over again.
But, like, worse somehow. It's all bad, but, like, also gimme. But so this fucking tower, so she doesn't kill herself, starts talking to her?
Okay.
Like, this is a weird tarot card alternate universe. Maybe. I don't quite understand. But, like, gimme them drugs, man. Gimme. Just gimme. But so, like, this talking tower structure thing tells her to go west to find the entrance to the underworld and make her way to Persephone. That way. So she doesn't have to kill herself to get there, right?
Yep.
But also, it warns her, while you're on your way to Persephone, don't speak to anyone. Don't talk to anybody.
Never. Don't listen to anybody.
Never talk to anybody. Never listen to anybody. Because reasons. Doesn't really get explained. She's like, don't do it. No, don't do it. And so off Psyche goes westward towards the entrance to the underworld. Also, I would like to reinforce at this point, I would just like to make sure you remember, Psyche is still pregnant.
Yeah, I know. I'm aware.
Psyche is still pregnant. She's gone through all these bizarre-ass fucking tests. She's still pregnant with her child with Eros. She's fucking preggo. And so she goes off to the west, which is a thing in Greek mythology. The underworld is just past the horizon to the west, far west.
Yeah.
It's a whole thing. So she goes to the west to find the entrance to the underworld. And she manages to find her way there. Well, sure. Big-ass fucking preggo.
Okay.
Because, I mean, at this point, it's been a hot minute since Eros fled and she got knocked up, right? So bit, she's not, like, about to give birth, but she's not, like, not low into this. She's not, like, you know, 3 months pregnant. She's, like, a big belly shit.
Gotcha.
So she makes her way off to the west. And so, one of the things that the literal stones of the tower let her know is, like, she needs to bring a bunch of shit with her to make her life, to make her way through the underworld a little easier. So, she goes west. She makes her her way past these spirits. There's, like, a few. One swimming through, like, the river Styx. And there's, like, one asking for her help. And some other, and, like, a third one that I don't remember.
Just gotta focus on getting out.
And she has to just ignore them and keep going. Because those are there solely to distract her. And she also brings cakes. She brings little cakes to give to Cerberus.
Have you brought me tiny cakes?
Have you brought me tiny cakes? So, she brings little cakes to give to Cerberus, or realistically, it should be pronounced Cerberus.
Spot. You mean.
Fun fact. Cerberus, or realistically, Cerberus, because it's based from a non-Greek or Latin language, comes from, like, Sanskrit Sumerian. More or less, it means spotted, which basically means that Hades named his big, terrifying, three-headed dog Spot. He named his dog Spot. Is that not the best thing? Honestly, that makes perfect sense to me. But I also like that it comes from a different non-Greco-Roman language.
She grabbed his
dog from
somewhere.
So it's like,
he adopted, didn't chop. Adopt, don't chop.
He adopted, don't chop, and he adopted fucking three-headed Spot over here.
He adopted a vicious three-headed dog named Spot.
You know, and that's I feel like Cerberus, meaning Spot, is why you get in Harry Potter books Fluffy the three-headed dog.
Exactly.
Yeah, same concept. It's a fun, cute little name for a terrifying thing, but that kind of tracks. Culturally speaking, it tracks. Anyway. So, so she leaves some cakes for him so he doesn't attack her while she passes on, while her, a living spirit, passes on by. And then, like, she crosses the moat, like, not the moat, the river. She crosses the river with Charon. And then she eventually makes her way past all these distracty boys, and she makes her way over to Persephone in the castle of the king of the underworld. Because, come on, we extra. And Persephone, our best girl, best queen of all time, listens to Psyche's pleas for, like, please, just help me out. I just need a drop of your beauty or whatever the fuck in this here box so I can get back to my husband, who I am pregnant with his child and shit. Presumably listens to these pleas and is like, yeah, all right. Takes the thing, drops something in the box, and then hands it back over to Psyche and sends Psyche on her way. Psyche finally gives Charon some coins to get back across the River Styx.
You gotta pay him if you wanna go.
Yeah, you gotta pay him both ways. It's the whole thing. So she, like, gives her coins, and she makes her way all the way back across towards the Land of the Living, headed back east. But the problem is, Psyche, ultimately, is only fucking human.
Of course.
Which is the thing in Greek mythology.
Yes.
She's only fucking human. And so, curiosity killed the cat here.
Obviously.
So Psyche, as soon as she gets to the world of the living, she opens the box.
Of course she does.
Because she's fucking curious. And she's
a dumbass, but curious.
She's dumbass, but I mean, like, I can't blame her as a white girl, because, I mean, same. She opens the box, and instead of being a drop of Persephone's beauty, which she thought could, like, help her out, it is a weird infernal sleep.
Yes.
And so it knocks Psyche the fuck out. She literally passes the fuck out asleep, basically forever. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, Eros has finally heard up from his, like, weird wax burns. Uh-huh. This is why I use paraffin wax, kids. And so he leaves his mom's house via fucking window.
Of course.
His mom doesn't want to let him go because Aphrodite is a possessive bitch. This is not necessarily a detraction against Aphrodite. It's just a fact. She's possessive of
also,
her
kiddos. Also, Eros is about 12. Forever. Also, like, mentally, like, in the way that he treats
like
his mother.
He's, like, an adult-y, but also not.
Looks like an adult, acts like a 12-year-old.
He's mostly an adult, but he's also, like, a mama's boy, is the thing.
Eros is a fuckboy by, like...
Not intentionally, but by way of being raised.
Pretty bad.
He was raised to be a mama's boy fuckboy.
He's pretty bad.
So, Eros basically jumps out a window to go find his lady friend. Slash wife. Not exactly his wife, because we get the technicalities of this marriage ceremony that was a funeral, technically. Whole thing. But so, he jumps out a fucking window to go find her. And find her he do. In a fucking field, just outside the entrance to the underworld. Except problem, she's magically forever asleep, which is no bueno. And so, he uses his fancy magical god powers.
Yes.
To, literally, as I read in my translations, to, quote, pull the sleep from her face.
I'm sorry, what?
Basically, it's like this concept of, like, the sleep is a thing that sprung out and attached to her face.
Okay.
Like a sticky thing that, like, sprung out of, like, it was a spring-loaded sticky thing that attached to her face. So he pulls that from her face is okay. The best way to visualize this. It's metaphorical, but also not.
Okay.
It's physical metaphorical. It's weird. It's Greek mythology.
That's fine.
But so he pulls the sleep from her face. He pulls the sleep out of her, essentially. The magical, eternal, infernal, quote-unquote, sleep. It is quote-unquote infernal because it comes from Hades, the underworld. Puts it back into the box. And then Psyche is still asleep. So he pricks her with one of his arrows.
Okay.
To wake her up.
Bitch, wake up.
He's like, poke! But, I mean, probably with a love arrow, just to be extra safe.
I mean, yes, of course. Obviously.
But he pricks her with an arrow to make sure she wakes the fuck up.
He's like, bitch, wake.
He's like, come on, babe. Babe.
Babe.
Babe. Babe. Honey. Anyway, so he, like, pricks with an arrow to make sure she actually fucking wakes up.
Yes.
And so, then he takes the box full of Persephone underworld sleep shit, drops it off with Aphrodite, his mamo, and then takes Psyche and takes her up to Olympus, specifically to get an audience with Zeus, to be like, yo, can you help me out?
Mm-hmm.
Cousin Zeus, can you help a bitch out here? Zeus is like, I can help you out if you help me fuck some random hot chicks. Whenever I want to fuck random hot chicks, you'll fucking shoot them with the sexy arrow.
Yes.
To make it happen. And Eros is like, yeah, I guess. Fine. Whatever. And so Zeus is like, we got a deal, shake. And then he summons all the other gods and shit, and he's like, okay, so I am so down with Eros and Psyche being married. Aphrodite, chill the fuck out. Please turn it down several notches.
Yes.
At least 5, minimum, because she was at like a 17. He's like, okay, Aphrodite, crank it down a little bit. And also, here, Psyche has some ambrosia, aka immortality juice.
Yes.
And that's that, basically, on that front. Everything's hunky-dory. Psyche is now technically immortal and a goddess, kind of. So they get married. Her and Eros. They get married. And they live happily ever after. Yay! For once, something went well in Greek mythology. They have a child.
Yes.
Whose name is escaping me. Hedone.
Yes.
Which is basically pleasure. That's where we get the word hedonism from.
Yes.
It's pleasure for the sake of pleasure. But it's like on a mental and sexual level because psyche.
Yes, of course.
You know, mental shit. Psychiatry and shit. And yeah, but also, like, they get married and she's immortal and it all goes well. Hooray! This is rare! Take the victories where you can get them in Greek mythology at the end. Okay. So we're going to take a second.
Pretty much.
2 seconds for pop culture shit. This one I've never particularly seen translated into pop culture because it's a one complicated and convoluted story.
I have an example.
Hold on. Bits and pieces do show up in places. Like when Cinderella is forced by her evil stepmother to sort lentils and peas from the ashes,
mm-hmm.
and the birds show up to help her.
Mm-hmm.
That is a thing where it shows up. And there are some parallels in other folklore and fairy tales. Specifically, one that comes to mind is the Norwegian folktale, East of the Sun, West of the Moon.
Yes.
Where she is trying to free her husband from his stepmother and the troll princess.
Pop culture?
It's not as much in pop culture proper, but it is an thing.
So I have an actual thing in which Psyche and Eros show up as like actual characters.
We're already on 2 fucking hours. I'm gonna hate this so much.
I know. That's your own problem. You're the one that
does it. I know.
Anyway,
because I got drunk and distracted.
But like I said, I have an actual thing in which Eros and Psyche show up as actual characters. Sherilyn Kenyon does her Dark Hunter series, which is a weird mix of vampires and Greek gods.
Who does
and like
this again?
Sherilyn Kenyon.
Okay, cool. I thought you were about to say some shit about Cassandra Clare.
No,
I would
no.
get into
well,
a. I would
that.
Launch an old diatribe
no, fuck
about
that.
Plagiarism.
No, whatever. Sherilyn Kenyon does her own thing about, like, vampires and, like, Greek gods.
Sure.
And, like, all. Well, not just Greek gods. She does, like, Persian gods and Roman gods and
all kinds of gods.
There's multiple pantheons.
It falls into place.
Well, she has a whole, like, universe in which the pantheons coexist in different ways. It's like, it's a whole thing. But, like, it's actually
I dig it.
Surprisingly well written for essentially what is, like, Nora Roberts novels with, mm-hmm. like, supernatural
with, like,
aspects.
Fucking sex and a bit of paranormal.
Yeah.
Mythological.
But, like, no, a lot of, like, supernatural.
A lot of supernatural, like, mythological, paranormal.
It's
shit.
Like, it's literally if you took a, like, if you took a Nora Roberts novel and just made it, like, a fucking episode of Supernatural, it's kind of what you would end up with like, a Sherilyn Kenyon novel.
So an Anne Rice novel?
Yeah, and also, like, Sherilyn Kenyon doesn't really shy away from, like, LGBTQ relationships. She also doesn't
That's
shy
exciting.
Away from, like, descriptions, like she understands trauma and how traumatic things can have far-reaching, like, effects on a life, even
right.
if you're technically, like, effectively immortal.
Okay.
You know what I mean? So, like, there's a lot going on. A lot of her, like, storylines and a lot of her characters have very dark or very intense pasts, usually.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting. But, yeah, she has a book... in which Eros and Psyche are, like, basically the main characters of, like, the first, like, couple chapters. Like, they show up, like, together, and it's, like, they are literally called, like, they're going by their actual names. And Eros does his thing where he just enjoys fucking with people, and he's, like, he's playing darts in this bar. And the darts are actually, you know,
love
his arrows.
Yeah.
And it's pretty entertaining. But yes, no, so like if you like mythology, but you also like schlocky romance novels.
I mean,
Sherilyn Kenyon, Dark Hunters, do it.
Anyway.
Anyway, I'm gonna let up.
So, Tristan and Isolde, or right. as I like to call it, a much better version of Romeo and Juliet.
I mean, there's not much worse versions.
Or kind of like Arthur, Lancelot, and Guinevere, but everybody behaves slightly better. So, the story originates from England in France in the 12th century and is essentially considered an epic poem. The story is, of course, like I was saying, Tristan and Isolde, which is just... It's one of those things where it's an origin story for a lot of stories that you've already heard.
Yeah.
The story originates from England and France in the 12th century and is considered an epic romantic poem that would literally later go on to influence Sir Thomas Malory, who wrote Le Morte d'Arthur. He wrote Le Morte d'Arthur, and it's basically the origin of the Arthur-Guinevere-Lancelot love triangle. It also went on to influence whoever you actually believe wrote Romeo and Juliet. If you're one of those people that think that Kit Marlowe wrote it, or if you're one of those people that believe that Shakespeare wrote it, it doesn't matter. Either way, same story. So basically, Tristan and Isolde is one of those...
inspiring boys.
It is an inspirational poem for a lot of different things that came up behind it.
Okay, that's fair.
So
okay,
Tristan...
I'm gonna land on go for a minute. If I need to talk more, I will scoot back over.
That's fine. So, Tristan, specifically, is a knight of indeterminate origin.
Sure.
He's probably also from Cornwall, considering that this is where the story takes place.
Sure.
But he, maybe not, you know.
Oh.
He's sworn to his uncle, who is King Mark of Cornwall, and has been fighting on his uncle's behalf for, you know, a while.
Alright, sounds reasonable.
He's an Irish knight named Morholt, who was probably the Irish queen's brother and also Isolde's uncle, came to Cornwall demanding tribute owed to them, but the people of Cornwall did not want to pay. So Tristan...
Yeah, because they're from fucking Cornwall.
Pretty much. So Tristan offers to fight the knight as a way to free Cornwall from its debt to Ireland.
Okay.
Now, at this point in the story, like, it can...
Specific.
It really is. So, like I was saying, at this point, the story can go in two different directions, leading to the exact same result. Option one, Tristan wounds Morholt to the point where he can no longer fight. He leaves a chunk of his fucking sword in Morholt's head. Morholt then stabs Tristan with a poisoned spear and goes and runs back to Ireland, essentially, like, is taken back to Ireland to heal. Now, Tristan, who is suffering from the poison of this stab wound, also goes to Ireland to be healed by the girl known as Isolde the Younger. The one who is the Isolde
the
of
one.
Yeah, of the story.
The hot one.
Her mother is also named Isolde.
What the fuck?
And she is known as Isolde the Elder.
Awkward.
And is
Spearing Junior. Over
yes,
here.
Exactly. And Tristan gets found out when the queen notices that there is a chunk missing from Tristan's sword that perfectly matches the chunk in Morholt's head. My observation on this was, who the fuck doesn't fix a sword for that long? It takes time to get from Cornwall to Ireland. And only that.
Not a short amount of time.
You know, like, you could fix a sword or you could just get a new sword. New sword is also an option.
Hold on. I would also like to point out, this reminds me, okay, don't get me wrong, I'm not crazy familiar with the story of Arthur. King Arthur. But this does a bit remind me of, like, once in Future King, he tries to kill his nephew, and then his nephew kills him, and it's like more goes and all this other shit. Am I off base here?
Because remember, I specifically mentioned that Thomas Malory, the author of Le Morte d'Arthur, was influenced directly by this story.
Right, that's right. You did mention that. Yeah, because that's all I can think
this
of.
This story predates the Arthur mythos by a couple hundred years.
Yeah, instead of being like, you know, fucking wherever the fuck, Cornwall? Versus Wales. Ireland or Wales or whatever the fuck.
Arthur is within England. Honestly.
Arthur is also within Wales, let's be real. But, okay.
But, like.
Cool. I am vaguely familiar with the Arthur mythology at best, and that's the first thing that popped to mind, and oh boy, I'm drunk.
Yes. But,
drunk.
You know,
history. Mythology edition.
Yes. That's why I was saying, that's like why I brought it up first.
Because okay, cool. That's a good point.
Tristan and Isolde, the story is much older than the Thomas Malory version of King Arthur, which is the
version
of...
Do we have an approximate...
From the
what is it?
Sorry, I'm like asking a bunch of awful questions.
12th century.
Oh, wow, that's impressive. It like predates, the Norman invasion shit.
Yes,
level.
It predates it, yes.
A century after the Norman invasion.
No, I mean, it predates the Arthurian myth as
Arthurian
we know it.
Arthurian myth and then, like, the Once and Future King level shit.
Yes.
Okay, cool. I'm sorry. I'm real drunk.
Because you have to remember that Thomas Malory was a Briton.
To make sure.
He was not a Briton, a Briton, which means he was from Brittany in France. Mm-hmm. And he was...
Which doesn't even fucking count according to the Brits.
It does, because most of the Britons in France were British folk just out of place because they went over there to claim land and stuff like that, and they were British families that became French that then became British again. So...
I'm approaching this from a Scotch-Irish perspective. It's throwing me off a little.
No, that's a whole different thing
entirely.
That's
a whole other thing where everybody hates England.
Yes, however, England was a major player for a very long time, and the Normandy, because Normandy is where the Bretons are from.
Right.
So you have to think about it this way. Like, most of those people in Normandy were
French-British. They're
French-British,
but also with, the teeniest scooch of Viking. It's a whole fucking mess.
Yes.
Because it's called Normandy because of the Normans.
Exactly.
AKA the Norsemen, or the people from the
exactly.
North, and it's just
but
a fucking mess.
The point being is that a lot of these stories interlock with each other because they are referential to each other, because they
and
are a weird melting
to a
of,
weird,
like...
bizarre cultural identity.
Exactly. And then
this
you have the story,
questions.
Which comes specifically from England.
Right.
And Ireland.
This particular story comes from England and Ireland. Yeah.
And France. Because there's a bit later that comes into play.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And,
this is why I ask questions.
Yes, but these stories are the ones that that influence those later stories, like Sir Thomas Malory and, you know, Shakespeare and stuff like that, that made people think that, oh, well, these are quintessentially British stories. They're not.
Surprise, they ain't.
They're not.
Surprise, bitch. Sorry, this is why I ask questions, and I also encourage you and our listeners to ask questions to get us to explain, because, like, while I am... relatively up on Greco-Roman, there are bits that escape me, especially when it comes to Breton and shit like that.
Yes.
Breton legends and Gallic legends and shit.
Exactly.
And I mean, I encourage you to ask me questions if I start talking about something you aren't as familiar with.
Amen. Because there's a lot going on.
Because there is so much that we have an entire fucking planet full of people who have their own mythologies, and sometimes you know them and sometimes you fucking don't. And
you can do all the research in the world, but there will come a time there's some things that you will always miss.
And interesting parts that you aren't going to fucking know unless you're looking into this bizarre level of cross-cultural comparative mythology.
And not necessarily just that. There's also regional differences between, you know,
that too,
stories.
And that's part of one of the things I've touched on with my my coyote story, is that there is fucking Aphrodite or anything, there are regional differences even within a same mythological grouping or a country or a region, and so it's important to ask questions to get a better, wider cultural understanding of how these things interact and fully create a mythology, especially when it's unified over a larger space.
Yes.
And that's why Zeus has so many girlfriends, and ultimately, that's the easiest way to phrase it, is like, why does Zeus have so many girlfriends? Because we have a cross-cultural perspective that integrate a lot of different mythologies into one larger mythology.
Yep.
So the big sky god has his own wives and girlfriends, and then it all gets wrapped together, so it all kind of overlaps.
Yes.
Thank you. Sorry, I feel like that's an important thing to talk about.
Thank you for coming to Kate's TED Talk.
And, yes, thank you for coming to my TED Talk, where I talk about bizarre cultural things that I only have a vague understanding of to begin with, especially when I'm drunk.
Anyway.
But anyways, I'm sorry. Tristan and Isolde.
Yes. So, basically...
I'm gonna lay down and continue eating carbs.
Yes. He does the thing, the queen realizes that Tristan is the one that nearly killed her brother.
Sure.
And, you know, suitably flips out. And she calls Tristan out on it. However, he is able somehow to broker a peace between Ireland and Cornwall, and is made to bring back Isolde to marry his uncle, the king, to solidify this peace.
Hey, girlfriend, you need to marry my uncle.
Yes. On the way back,
they make things better, apparently.
On the way back, they ingest a love potion, which some say was on purpose, some say was on accident. There's no, like, definitive.
This is some definite Midsummer Night's Dream bullshit.
They accidentally ingest a love potion, or on purpose ingest a love potion, nobody knows.
Whatever.
That causes them to fall madly in love. Now, option two, Tristan straight up defeats Morholt and goes to collect a soul for his uncle. And again, how they actually brokered the peace isn't really, like, important. But it's under the same flag of encouraging peace between Cornwall and Ireland. So he goes to retrieve Isolde, and on the back, they take the same love potion, etc., etc. Now, depending on the version of the story, the love potion either works for their entire lives, or stops working after 3 years, leaving them with the decision as to whether or not they actually love each other.
Okay.
So,
I blame myself.
Depending on the version of the story, the love potion either works for their entire lives or actually stops working after 3 years, leaving them with the decision as to whether or not they actually love each other. So, regardless, Tristan does his job and brings Isolde to his uncle, and Isolde and the king marry. This does not actually stop Isolde from Tristan and boning. Like, Isolde isn't from boning. They bone a lot. However, they both feel really bad about it because
they should.
The king, Mark of Cornwall, is honestly, like, Tristan's surrogate father. And Isolde really likes him because he's super respectful and very nice. They try to keep the fact that they're conducting this affair under wraps, but of course these kind of shenanigans can only go for so long before people notice. So the king tries to live in denial for a while, because he really loves both of them. Like, that's his son and his, like, wife. So he's like, I'm gonna try to not deal with this.
I'm gonna ignore it.
But finally, solid evidence is brought before the king, and he just can't continue to ignore the truth. So he sentences Tristan to die by hanging, and initially sets Isolde to burn at the stake, but commutes her sentence to the banishment in a leper colony. Leprosy means that your nerves die first, so, like, you can't feel the chunks falling off. You can't. It's true. Anyway, so on the day of his execution, and the day that Isolde was supposed to be sent to the leper colony, Tristan manages to escape on his way to the gallows, making what is described as one hell of a leap from a chapel.
Say that again?
Yeah, he makes what's described as one hell of a leap and rescues Isolde before she can be sent away. They basically fucking just hotfoot it to the Forest of Morrigh, which nobody knows where that is, and I looked it up on Google and I searched for a real long time, can't figure out where the fuck that's supposed to be.
No idea.
And
it's mythical and fantastic.
They stay like there.
Babylon.
Yes, and they stay there until the king actually catches up with them. Now, instead of killing them, King Mark allows Isolde to return to his side under the agreement that Tristan will leave Cornwall forever. Which, you know, I feel is pretty fucking reasonable for that time period.
Reasonable.
Like, you know, they were, like, trying to figure out how to stop years of war with Ireland, and these two jackasses had just risked the entire fucking thing. Now, in one version of the story, at this point, some shit goes down, and the king stabs Tristan with yet another fucking poisoned lance while he's playing the harp for Isolde.
Okay, hold on. How many poison lances has the boy stabbed with at this point? Three?
Oh, one now. This is the second one. Three total in the story.
What the fuck? How many poison lances are there? Good lord.
My point. In the first version of the story, you know, some shit goes down and the king stabs Tristan with yet another poison lance while he's playing the harp for Isolde, and he dies there in the forest, and Isolde goes on to spend the rest of her life married to Mark. Which is fine. And in the other version of the story, Tristan leaves Cornwall as an exile and moves to Brittany, where he marries a woman who is named, get this, Isolde of the White Hands.
Hold up. Hold the fuck up. No, I need a minute here.
There are three Isoldes in the story.
There are so many Isoldes. But so, because he can't have the first one who married his uncle, he marries another woman, also conveniently named Isolde.
It's literally because she's hot and her name is Isolde. Those are the reasons that he marries her. So assuming that Tristan actually makes it to Brittany and doesn't die in that forest, He gets into a fight with six knights defending some random maiden's honor.
Sure.
And gets stabbed with another fucking poison lance. Holy
Where the
shit.
Fuck do people keep finding these poison fucking lances?
I don't know.
Legitimate question. Where do you keep finding all these goddamn poison lances?
Don't know.
That's so many.
Like, if you look at my notes, it's written in all caps because I was just like, what the fuck?
One is excessive. Two is just, like, bonkers. Three is just
like unnecessarily much.
How does this keep happening?
Anyway, so because he's been living in Brittany, he's made some friends and has some buddies. He sends his friend Caden to Cornwall to find Isolde of Ireland, or, you know, as we know, you knew her from earlier, Isolde the Younger.
Hot bitch Isolde.
The OG Isolde.
OG Isolde that he wanna fuck.
So...
Let me smash.
Because she's the only person who knows how to heal him, because she healed him of his previous poison lance wound.
The last fucking two poison lance wounds.
Essentially.
That happens often.
And tells his friend to sail back with white sails if Isolde is coming with him, and black if she's not. His wife, again, also named Isolde, is
so
with him.
Weird!
Yes.
How do you keep finding all these people named Isolde?
Apparently it was the popular name of the time. So...
I hate everything.
His wife, Isolde, is... with him in this room as he's laying on a sickbed, and she's looking out the window and sees Caden returning and tells this to Tristan that she sees him coming.
Mm-hmm.
And Tristan is like, what color are the sails? And poor wife Isolde, and very justified fit of jealousy, tells him that the sails are fucking black. And Tristan, upon hearing that the sails are black, promptly dies of grief.
Okay, hold on. No, I recognize this from Greek mythology. Hold up,
I don't want to listen to you Google things. Let me finish my fucking story.
Finish your story.
Wife Isolde tells him that the sails are black, and Tristan promptly dies of grief because OG Isolde is not coming back to help him. So, this is something that wife Isolde did not expect, because she thought that he would just, like, deal with it, but no, he died. So, OG Isolde gets up to the room, sees Tristan dead on the bed, and swoons and collapses dead herself.
As one did.
The story does not mention what happens to Isolde the wife, which I personally find fucking rude.
Rude. She deserves better.
So
it's not her fault this dude was fucking weird.
Right? So Isolde and Tristan's bodies are returned to Cornwall, and they're buried near each other by King Mark, who honestly is, like, the most decent, like, villain, I guess? Like, hero's foil?
Villain!
Villain
is,
like,
really
it's not accurate.
Here.
It's, like, just
he's
person
not a
who is
bad
in the way.
Guy. He's a foil to the hero.
Yeah, he's the hero's foil. And he's just, like, the most decent version of that in just about any story I've ever read. And as the legend goes, a thick bramble briar grew out of Tristan's grave and forms a bower over the grave of Isolde. And on Isolde's grave, there's a rose bush growing, and the two plants have intertwined because the lovers have refused to be parted in death the way that they were parted in life.
Okay, also, can I say Isolde Mark II was totally in the fucking right to be like, okay, your bitch-ass ex-girlfriend's dead.
Yeah. No, it wasn't that she was dead.
No.
It was that she just wasn't
girlfriend
there.
Ain't coming.
Yeah.
And then he fucking dies of sadness. Bullshit.
Some Padme with all her bullshit.
Oh my god, no.
She's just giving up the will to live.
That's fake canon. I don't agree with it.
Anyway.
So basically, I feel like the message here is that be good to your wife and don't be a shit ass.
So that she doesn't do things like, you know, lie at a critical
lie
moment.
And don't, you know, honesty is key, I think, is where this boils down to. But also don't suck.
So
honesty and not being a shitlord.
Yes. And also maybe don't fuck your uncle's wife.
Yeah. Also that, but just in general, be honest with your wife, I feel like is what this boils down to. If Eros was honest with Psyche, she wouldn't have fucking brought a candle over to see, like, I don't know, is this a weird snake monster that I need to kill? If,
So going back to
Tristan
Eros
was
Psyche
honest
again.
With, Isolde Mark II, she wouldn't be like, no, the cells are black.
So, going back to the Eros and Psyche thing.
Right.
So, like, the reason that Eros doesn't tell Psyche that he's Eros.
Yeah,
is because he is
under
preternaturally attractive.
and he wants to see if she is attracted to him
because
of him, rather than because he is a god of, you know, lust, essentially.
Don't pity marry people.
Exactly.
Who have the same name as your ex-girlfriend.
That's actually more accurate.
Don't
marry the person for a reason.
Marry a person for a reason, not because they have the same name as your ex-girlfriend or because they're hella hot or whatever the fuck.
Precisely. Because literally,
you know, be a good spouse.
The description of Isolde of the White Hands, which is the wife,
secondary wife.
She was super hot and her name was Isolde. That's literally what it boils down to.
Yeah.
Like, that's it.
Don't do that, team. Don't do that one.
So, for our pop culture moment,
there
is actually a pretty fucking decent movie from 2006 named Tristan and Isolde. That stars James Franco as Tristan and Sophia Miles as Isolde.
Hold on. James Franco?
Surprisingly good.
James Franco.
Yes.
Isn't it, that's the Baz Luhrmann version, right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
I'm pretty sure because Tristan plus, right? And they do that
And like Romeo and Juliet. Yes.
Yeah, that's a Baz Luhrmann one. Yeah. James Franco is in it?
Surprisingly good. Hair is terrible. The acting is pretty great.
Hold on, James Franco.
Yes.
Is that who's in it?
So it's James Franco as Tristan, Sophia Miles as Isolde, and Rufus Sewell as King Mark of Cornwall.
Fuck.
The dude that looks like Joaquin Phoenix but isn't.
Oh, fuck. That's what the fuck.
You know who I'm talking about.
No, I know who you're talking about.
I feel like that's like the best description of Rufus Sewell, is that guy that looks kind of like Joaquin Phoenix but isn't.
No, I literally just Googled him and yeah, no, I get you exactly, but also what the fuck.
He's in a lot of things.
It's just
anyway
throwing me.
Yes, but it's actually a surprisingly good movie.
Is it?
My standards were really low when I went to go see that movie, but
valid.
Significantly higher than what I expected it to be.
That's pretty
good. And it has a great ending because it does its own thing, kind of, because Baz Luhrmann kind of turns it into its.
Baz Luhrmann. He do a thing.
He does the
thing. He does his thing.
Where, so, like, in the story where, you know, like the first option ending of Tristan and Isolde, where Tristan dies in the forest.
Sure.
He kind of does this thing where both Mark and Tristan die, and Isolde just kind of has to live on for the rest of her life with the fucking weight of these deaths on
her
hands.
That's really better.
It's much better, honestly. And it's a really cool story. Like, I honestly... Watch it. It's like, it's one of those things I would not normally recommend watching this movie.
Listen, I love Baz Luhrmann.
I also love Baz Luhrmann.
He's such a good director.
It's
I'll check that out at some point.
It's not a typical Baz Luhrmann movie. It's almost like Ice Castles.
I mean, I haven't seen that or Australia, so.
Oh, I've watched Australia. That was a slog.
I hear.
It was good, though.
I hear it's good, but it's just like, you know, three fucking hours.
Okay, exactly. Like, it was really good.
It's
Jackman is
so
amazing.
Long.
Nicole
That's
Kidman is amazing.
That's because Hugh Jackman is perfect.
But Nicole Kidman is also amazing.
That's
But it's so long.
It's so much.
It was almost like watching Gone with the Wind.
Light me on fire.
My Sonya and I
watched Gone with the Wind the whole way through,
also,
and I want to light myself on
fire.
Sonya
and I had to do the thing
again.
That Gone with the Wind, like the DVD for Gone with the Wind, comes with a fucking intermission.
You mean the VHS?
Yes.
Where
but
you get to an intermission.
No, the DVD also has an intermission.
Well, it was built into the original fucking film where you have to, like, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours
so
in.
Long.
You just have to take a break to fucking be done.
So Sonya and I literally had to just take a 20-minute intermission while watching Australia. We, like, found, like, the middle point of the movie. We're like, we're just gonna stop here.
It's time for
and
break.
Walk away.
It's time to
Because
Baz Luhrmann, I love you.
Don't get me wrong.
Lord.
It's a good story. But there is only so long that I can watch a story about cattle farmers in Australia before I'm like,
I love cows.
Gotta walk
sounds
away.
Like so much.
Gotta walk away.
That's so much.
Australia's great. Like, if you have 4 hours of your time that you don't mind wasting,
sure,
go ahead.
But
Tristan and Isolde, not that long.
Not as long.
But like,
a little more satisfying.
Yes.
Okay.
And also, like, again, surprisingly good. Like, James Franco is one of those actors that can, like, kind of pull it out when he needs to.
He is when he's not high as balls.
And he's not. Like, he doesn't look like
he's stoned out of his
Yeah, exactly. And, of course, Sophia Miles is one of those people that, like, you know...
Because she's Sophia Miles.
Jenny.
I can accept this.
Jenny from Doctor Who.
Oh, my God, you're right.
the doctor's daughter.
You're right.
Who is actually the doctor's daughter.
And also married.
Yeah.
Holy shit, that's her?
That's her.
When she was what, like 15?
I mean,
Jesus Christ.
David Tennant and Mary here is probably older than
they
that.
They have a kid, so you know.
Yeah.
Shruggy shrug, but also like, whatever.
Yes. All right. Anyway.
All right.
But again, like I said, if you guys are interested in the story, it is a pretty decent retelling of the story. It's not great, not perfect, but like.
But you know, also
entertaining.
Not like 12 years long.
Yeah, and it's entertaining as fuck. So like.
You know, it's valuable.
Kind of reminds me of Braveheart in that way that Braveheart is not historically accurate.
No, it is fucking
very
not.
Entertaining to watch.
Yeah, but that was also like 25 years ago before we knew Mel Gibson was absolutely
exactly.
a racist piece
and,
of shit.
Okay,
a racist,
so like
girlfriend beating piece of shit.
As a female and
sorry.
As an ethics
sorry.
Person and as a person that you know has
ethics are bizarre.
We have a lot going on with Mel Gibson.
And dependent.
It's kind of like Mel Gibson is kind of like Charlie Sheen.
How about Mel Gibson is kind of like Kevin Spacey?
No.
Where we can appreciate things, but that doesn't mean
no,
we're okay with it.
Hold on. I'm gonna say something that might be considered controversial.
No,
right?
Hot take. Give me a hot
take.
So,
like,
we can edit it out if we need to.
Mel Gibson is kind of like Charlie Sheen, right? Where Charlie Sheen is a fucking terrible person and has done terrible
and
person things.
And also a crazy human being.
Yes, but he's got that weird charm to him. We're like, you're like,
oh,
I
yeah.
fucking hate him. And then he comes on screen, and you're like, oh my god, Charlie Sheen. And you kind of just.
And you're like, Charlie Sheen?
You kind of just start watching
like,
him
you're
regardless.
Like, Charlie Sheen. And first you're like, Charlie Sheen.
And then you're like, oh,
you're
god, Charlie Sheen.
Charlie Sheen?
Yeah.
Like, he was in the first Machete movie.
Yes.
And he was. No, the second one. Sorry, he was in Machete Kills.
Yeah.
And they were like, you know, introducing Emilio Estevez. And it was great.
Okay, hold on.
Because
time
they
out,
actually
pause.
Acknowledged him being vaguely Hispanic.
Hold on. So, time out. Pause. Real quick.
Uh-huh.
So, of the two people that should have changed their name, right?
Uh-huh.
Emilio Estevez of that family. Emilio Estevez should have been the dude that changed his name. His blonde-haired, blue-eyed self looks the least Hispanic. Charlie Sheen, on the other hand, could have been Carlos Estevez.
Carlos Estevez. That's his name. There's too many people in that family.
It's Michael
All
Sheen,
the Sheens,
Charlie Sheen.
Michael Sheen,
Emilio
Charlie
Estevez.
Sheen, Emilio, and they he changed.
Don't get me wrong, I love Emilio Estevez, but like
Thank
I remember finding
me.
Out for the
but
first
yeah,
time that Charlie
Carlos
Sheen.
Yeah, in Machete Kills, they introduce him because he plays the American
mm-hmm.
peasant as Carlos Estevez.
Again, as a child, finding out that Charlie Sheen was like
Hispanic.
And that Emilio Estevez and Charlie Sheen were brothers was like a.
How about finding out Cameron Diaz actually is fucking Hispanic?
I know, right?
Blonde haired, green eyed Carmen Diaz.
No, mind you, I say this.
Cameron Diaz, sorry.
Yeah, no.
Is Hispanic.
I say this
fucking
with an aunt that is blonde haired, blue eyed, and a cousin that's red haired and green eyed because it's a thing that happens.
It is.
But
I'm
like,
not disagreeing.
But like.
It's also strange.
It is always strange because
the
I always just assume
that, like,
that Charlie
yeah.
Sheen was like Italian or like white or something.
You know, swarthy, but white.
Yeah.
Swarthy,
like,
but white adjacent.
Emilio Estevez, I was always
like,
well, he's obviously some sort of weird Spaniard Spanish.
Yeah,
and then
or like,
was like,
you know,
oh,
Nazis
no.
and shit.
Yeah, I was like, somebody was
but
like, oh, no,
Spain.
They're brothers. And I was like.
What the fuck?
I distinctly remember being like 7 and just
okay.
be like, what the fuck?
We're at almost a 3-hour mark, so let's wrap this up.
Oh, yeah.
And then we can do drunken sing-alongs.
We might
the
have
fuck.
To do that, like. Next week because it's 2 in the morning.
We can do it.
You
we
have to be
do.
Up at 10. You have to be up before 10.
I have to be up
10.
At like 7 a.m.
Yeah, let's.
But I'll suffer regardless. Is there anything else you need to say?
Tristan and Isolde is a far superior story to Romeo and Juliet. Romeo
yeah,
Juliet
because Romeo and Juliet ain't
terrible.
Romantic. It's a bunch of teenagers doing stupid teenager shit and then
so,
killing
like,
themselves.
Yeah, I was gonna say, Romeo and Juliet is always classed as one of Shakespeare's tragedies, but personally I feel like it should be classed as one of Shakespeare's comedies.
It's a comedy in that it's funny and lighthearted up until Act 4.
In which
and
it turns, it takes a very dramatic turn.
There is a marriage, and then it takes a bizarre turn.
Again.
It's not a comedy in that nobody gets married at the end, which
matter.
Is the classic definition of a comedy.
I don't
a
care.
Shakespearean comedy.
I completely understand.
It should be just kind of off in its own category.
No. I completely understand, but I honestly feel like it should be one of Shakespeare's comedies because I feel like the deaths are part of a comedy of errors. It is. The deaths are a comedy of errors.
Kind of. But it's like in this weird in between where it's not quite a comedy of errors and it's not quite a tragedy.
If you placed.
It'd be a comedy of errors proper if it ended happily and it don't.
Neg. If you took the fourth act of Shakespeare and made it the first act of a different Shakespeare play, it would be a comedy.
Yeah, that's fair.
So it is a comedy.
Or if it just ended in act three, it would be a comedy.
The priest, the what's his face? The father, the Franciscan friar.
The friar.
He is a comedic character, and even when shit is going, and so is the nurse, and even when shit is going incredibly terribly, they're still fucking cracking jokes.
They're fucking hilarious.
Till the end.
The nurse is the funniest shit I've ever seen.
So, you can try to argue that Romeo and Juliet isn't a comedy, but it is. It's a comedy.
It's a comedy, it's a black and then comedy. It goes weird.
No, it's just a black comedy.
Yeah. I'm saying from a traditional sense of the concept of Shakespearean plays, it's a comedy and then just kind of goes sideways.
Here's the thing, right? I always disagree with the phrase traditional Shakespearean because
Shakespeare's plays are not traditional. But I'm saying as like the general literary categorization. It's a comedy that goes sideways.
Well, let me put it to you this way, right?
But
imagine,
it's ultimately
right?
kind of a comedy in the traditional sense.
Hold on. Let me put it to you this way, right?
Right.
Let's pick an author. J.K. Rowling, right?
I'm gonna hate you so much when I'm editing this.
But say J.K. Rowling died today, right?
Okay.
Right? And it's now 600 years in the future. And the only examples of J.K. Rowling's work that have made it to 600 years in the future are Harry Potter and The Casual Vacancy.
The Casual Vacancy? That's bold. Sorry.
But, like, no.
Sorry, I'm being a lit crit here. Don't mind me. No, but, okay, so Harry Potter and The Casual Vacancy.
Right? So, if you have these eight works by the same author, seven of which are following a trend, and one of which that doesn't fit...
is rando, yes.
Most historians and literary critics are going to try to fit this one thing into the other seven.
That's fair. That's a good point.
So, consider that Romeo and Juliet is one of Shakespeare's later works.
It is one of his later works. In the same way that The Tempest doesn't quite fit into any of his works. Same concept.
Exactly. You can't really fit them into the later works because this range of works.
We don't have a full context and understanding of what he was doing with
them. We don't know where he was going with his art. We don't know what he was writing. We don't know what the context was for the situation
of that
play.
Because a lot of his plays were within a certain trend or commentary on
of
the time.
So,
and then on top of that, The Tempest, everyone's like, I don't know how to categorize The Tempest, and it's the same concept.
Exactly.
Where it's like, it falls into a number of categories.
I always say
no
to
answer.
People, exactly, which is why I always say to people when they're like, oh no, Romeo and Juliet is a tragedy, I'm like, it's a comedy. And you really can't convince me otherwise.
I'm like, it's just its own fucking thing.
It's a comedy. It is a fucking dark comedy. And if you try to describe it as anything, it doesn't make any sense.
It doesn't fit into the classical definition.
Because it's not actually tragic.
It doesn't have to be a tragedy, and it doesn't have to be a comedy outright either. It's its own thing.
If you actually look at what happens in Romeo and Juliet,
one of Shakespeare's big things is like shaking it up and playing with and subverting the tropes of the time.
Exactly,
that's a fair point.
And the thing is like if you look at that play, like if you actually look at what's written, the words that are used, the characters that are when they're saying their lines, and how things end.
The nurse is like the bodiest character I ever got a chance to read in high school.
But my point
she's dirty.
It's like if you actually really go through it like that and you actually read through the entire thing, by the end of the play, you should think this is just a dark comedy.
Yeah, you should. You're like, this is not an ideal romance in any form.
Oh no.
As a person,
fucking high schooler, I was like, are you serious?
Like the fucking Taylor Swift song, I'm like, isn't romantic. It ends in a horrifying double suicide and a bunch of families ruined forever.
At least in Tristan and Isolde, when you get
it's not
it,
a double suicide.
No, but they love you. Like if you ever like
it's actual love, and
if
not
you get a chance to read
against their parents.
Yes. If you get a chance to read the actual story, they're adults first off.
Yeah.
Secondly, they get to know each other first. They're in each other's company for a decent amount of time. They fall in love. Weird shit happens, and it kind of amplifies that, and it goes kind of weird. But, like, there's, like, an actual story before that.
That's my thing with Romeo and Juliet.
Starts with Romeo fucking pining over her fucking cousin.
Yeah. Now, Romeo and Juliet is literally a 14-year-old and a 19-year-old. Sorry, a 12-year-old and, like, a maybe 18-year-old going, like, oh, we should get together because it'll piss off our parents, you know, in classic teenager fashion. So they do the literal teenager thing, like, this will make our parents real angry, and then they go and then get married and they have sex and then they kill themselves to piss off their parents. That's ultimately what it is.
I remember reading this in high school.
Juvenile teenager bullshit.
So I remember reading this in high school, and as a 16-year-old reading this in fucking high school,
as
and
a 14-year-old.
And watching, like, the fucking
the 60s,
like,
version?
60s version of the
movie.
The
naked butt?
Yeah.
You get me.
I remember just being like, as they're watching this, I was just like, excuse me?
Is this supposed to be, like...
Is this supposed to be funny, or is this supposed to be sad?
No. We watched the weird Italian version with the naked butt from the 60s, and then we watched...
And then we watched Romeo and Juliet, the Baz Luhrmann version.
Yes! Same! And it was much better because I loved that version already.
My English teacher, I actually, like, really appreciate, because she was like, this play boils down to one theme. And the theme
one
is
of the things,
obsession.
One of the things my dad told me from when I was, like, very young is that, like, ultimately, this play is about teenagers being shitty to get back at their parents, and it goes too far.
So I really I really appreciate the way that my English teacher explained it to me, because her thing was like, it's when you're a teenager and you feel like you're in love with somebody, you obsess over that thing.
Because she's a fucking child.
And she's like, literally, the entire theme of this play is that obsession is dangerous. The parents are obsessed with their rivalry.
With their rivalry.
The children are obsessed with each other.
Yeah,
you know, like, about how obsession destroys relationships.
Yep.
And I was like,
I get that.
That's really a fucking great point. And honestly, it stuck with me forever. And also because she used to do the obsession for men. Like, you know, like the perfume commercial.
Yeah, my dad phrased it as, like, you know, it's these parents having this horrifying vindictive conflict against each other, and children are vindictive against their parents.
Yes, they're internalizing and
they're internalizing this bizarre, this, like, weird conflict that makes no sense to them because it's been going on for generations, has nothing to do with them, and so far removed that then they in turn are being vindictive and getting revenge on their parents.
Exactly.
And the ultimate act of revenge is getting married and then being upset and killing themselves.
But that's the thing. Like, Romeo and Juliet, I hate...
To prove, essentially, a point that their fucking feud is futile. And that's the only way to fix it. And it's all terrible.
I hate, hate, hate when I see kids reading...
It's not romantic.
It's not romantic.
It's not romantic. You're not Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, I saw some, like, a friend of mine has
like
a
kid, like I said,
kid,
Taylor
right?
Swift.
A friend of mine has a kid, and they posted a thing about how, like, oh, me and my boyfriend are so in love with each other, we're like Romeo and Juliet. Now it's just like...
Light yourself on fire. Please summon an apothecary and make sure you have an antidote to the poison that you're about to ingest.
Honestly?
You dumb bitch.
Even if we're going within Shakespeare's plays...
Good lord.
Antony and Cleopatra would be a better fucking pairing.
And it's even not good. That's also
Oh no,
not
it
good.
Still doesn't end well.
It's still
but
not
that's
great.
Not
but it's
like
less terrible.
Exactly.
By, you know, a small
margin. I mean,
margin.
They both die, but, like, you know, for
you
different
know.
Reasons.
Still though. Okay,
anyway.
So we need to wrap this
up. Yeah, wrap it up.
All right. Is there anything else you feel the need to say?
Nope.
Are we done here?
Yep.
We're done here?
Yep.
You gotta say the thing. We're done here.
We're done here.
Excellent. So if you have any comments, concerns, or things you want to add, stories you feel like we should be telling, or otherwise sources on information that we may have missed in our research, if you're interested in liking us, you can find us on social media at Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Flights of Fancy. You can also find us on Patreon and at Ko-fi.com, which is ko-fi.com, at Flights of Fancy. I think that is about it. We're done here. And anything else, Patricia, before we leave?
We are all good to go.
We are set. It's time to be done. All right.
Three-hour long recording session.